Blog Talk Radio.
Another episode we have here of Suspense Radio. I am your host, John Robb. Today, 90-minute show coming to you. We have three great guests. Coming up first here in just a second is going to be debut author, a thriller fiction author, Amy Sojai. Next will then be Keith Rommel. And last will be David Lyons. If you listen to the show, you'll know that we played David Lyons' clip on the air. So now we actually get to talk to him. But it's October, and the leaves are out. They're starting to change. Well, at least not in Southern California. But around the country, things are starting to get cooler. But we're heating up. 90 Minutes of Suspense Radio starts right now. Everybody, here we go, off and running on another great Saturday morning, October the 6th. If you're not listening live, it is the October the 6th show, and we want to jump right in here to our first guest, like I said, debut fiction author, with her newest book called Lost and Found, came out on September the 20th. Amy Sojai is our guest. Amy, thank you so much for joining us. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me, John. This is a thrill, no pun intended, to be on Suspense Radio.
You know, not a lot of people say it's a thrill. They all kind of are nice to me and say that it's so nice to be on, but only if they knew me in person would they not say that. But that's great to know. I really appreciate that. And so, and we're going to get here now because your book, like I said, Lost and Found, your latest book, September 20th, your first realm into the fiction world, fiction, yes, thriller world, because you have an extensive background, of course, and in dogs and a lot of, you know, and pets and animals, and you decided to come into fiction and write about this. Tell everybody a little bit about Lost and Found, and, you know, like, you're thinking of, you know, why now was the time for you to kind of jump in here to the thriller fiction world?
Oh, great question, John. And I've as people will know if they've looked into the pet book realm, I have two dozen nonfiction pet books. I'm a certified animal behavior consultant, and pets, for me, rule my world. They rule my life, and I think for a lot of people, they do. And I've been a thriller fan just forever. I read thrillers. I love it when authors include their pets in the storyline, but oftentimes they don't quite ring true for me. So I thought this was an opportunity for me to expand the world of pets and edutain, if you will, about pet behavior. I have a dog viewpoint character in Lost and Found. Basically, the book is an autism cure will kill millions unless a service dog and his trainer find a missing child in 24 hours. And so I actually have a dog viewpoint character in the book, and I know there were a lot of people that were thinking, oh, it must be a kid's book, oh, it must be fantasy, oh, it must be, you know, whatever. It's not. It's, of course, I'm hoping it's going to appeal to a wide range of readers, but Lost and Found is very much what I wanted to read as a thriller fan. And so the main character is September, a lady who is suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, having her husband was a cop and was killed, and she lost her own dog. She's an animal trainer. She moves home to Texas to be closer to family and has trained a service dog for her nephew who is autistic, and young Stephen, a seven-year-old, gets lost in a freak blizzard with his service dog. And from there, the story just sort of spirals out of control with all kinds of things going on.
Mm-hmm.
But you will find, I mean, for people who like nonfiction, who like dogs, who like cats, there's a trained cat in the story that figures in the solution, actually is a hero cat at the end. And I know people think that cats can't be trained, so you may be surprised at that. And, of course,
I train my cat to know when it's time for her wet food. She knows exactly what it is.
Yes.
She knows the sound, and she comes bolting out wherever she's out. So a cat might be independent and have the stuck-up attitude, but they can be trained.
Absolutely. And I think cats actually, in some instances, are smarter than dogs, or even smarter than humans, because cats know how to train their human to open the door or to get up at 3 in the morning and fill the bowl and all of those good things. So you're going to learn a lot about pets and behavior and how animals interact with people and how some of the miscommunications, what you think you're saying and what the dog actually is understanding what you're saying, and what dogs want out of life, what people want out of life, where the two coincide, maybe when they're in conflict with each other. And then also on the human scale, we have in Lost and Found, there is a mother who has this autistic child, and like every parent, wants the absolute best for their child. I mean, if you could find a cure for something that ailed your child and made him normal again, made him perfect again, you'd nearly sell your soul to do that. And this parent just goes above and beyond and maybe makes a bet on the wrong cure. So I think it touches on a lot of different things that provoke an emotional response. And that's kind of what I was going for here. And in the reviews so far, it's been very gratifying. I'm getting roller coaster ride and emotional response and all those good things that an author loves. And I never got that with my nonfiction books other than...
No, well, except, oh, that's cute.
Well, one nonfiction book is the First Aid Companion for Dogs and Cats, and it's a technical book that vet techs use as a training tool. And so I have had pet owners come up and thank me for saving their pet's life, and I didn't even know them, and that's very gratifying. But this is a whole other realm, so I'm really enjoying the ride.
Now, when you're writing a book, and of course you know it's a thriller, and if people would have caught on, I did a very detailed analysis of exactly kind of what suspense, thriller, mystery, and horror, and I broke down the genres. And it's very much good to know that you understand that it is a thriller, because when you're putting in your book that you have 24 hours to rescue something, that's a very, very fast-paced book going on. And you have to do a lot of things within, that one day. You're fitting a lot of things into that. Was it difficult when you got into it? Was it like, this is maybe a little bit too much and maybe I should kind of spread it out? How was your thought process while you went through it? Since this is your first fiction, I mean, that's very much a difficult attempt to do that kind of a fast pace. Typically, a lot of writers might come out if they've never done, fiction before. They kind of do suspense because it's a little easier to write because you don't quite have to be so fast. The action doesn't have to quite be so great all the time.
I probably did it that way because I didn't know any better, because it is my first book.
And sometimes that's the best way to do.
Well, and it's what I like to read. It really is. And I live in North Texas, so this is my community. This is actually based on something that happened here a couple of years ago. North Texas doesn't get snow. Rarely gets snow.
Yeah.
And we had a freak snowstorm. We had a blizzard. And it occurred to me, and it was during some of the early plotting for this book, it occurred to me, oh my gosh, what would happen if a child got lost in this and it was a special needs child and the rescuers couldn't even get there and what would happen? And it was that whole what if, and if a child is lost in the snow and hyperthermia is an extreme risk, you have that ticking clock alone, and then add that to other things. So probably the biggest challenge to me was to do the timeline so that I have a number of different viewpoint characters. Of course, September is the main viewpoint character. There is also a policeman that is going after her, and then the dog, the mother of the child. So there are several viewpoint characters, and I alternated chapters. And to try to get the timeline of everything that was going on, I had to rearrange some of those things. So that was a challenge. The biggest thing for me was when I write nonfiction, I can multitask. I've done three books at once plus, you know, half a dozen nonfiction articles all at the same time. No problem. You know,
right.
They pick up the phone, the researcher calls me back, and I pull that file, and I need to do the interview. That's no problem. A lot of problems with the fiction. Hopefully I will get better at that, but for fiction I had to immerse myself into September's world, into the lost and found world, and any phone call I got, any doorbell ring, the dog needs to go for a walk, the cat needs the food, it took me out of that. It took me a while to get back into it. I got better as I went along, but that was probably the biggest challenge for me, so it took quite a while for this book to be written and then revised, of course, because of, as probably every listener out there knows, it's never the first draft or the third draft
right.
or the 20th draft. It's, you know, a million drafts in until you finally find something that seems to work.
Now, when you decided that you were going to do this and coming from the nonfiction world, and again, everybody, we are speaking here with author Amy Sojai, and her book is called Lost and Found, and it's sojai.com, S-H-O-J-A-I.com is her website to find out more information. But when you decided that you're going to start entering this world, did you go to any events? Did you contact any authors to kind of try to get advice of kind of, you know, how they decided to kind of go into it? Because it is something that's very difficult from somebody who's written a lot of nonfiction pet books and things like that to be able to jump into that world. So did you heed any advice from anybody?
Here's a confession. I have wanted to be a fiction author since before I published my first nonfiction book. And at that time, I was writing horror. And it was not really very popular at the time. I had a young protagonist in that particular book that will, thank goodness, never see the light of day. And I submitted it to a very well-known agent who declined but said, oh, by the way, if you have a good background, if you want to do nonfiction, and we ended up doing many books together. So from a long time ago, I've wanted to do fiction. I've studied fiction. I've attended writers' conferences, workshops. I have been to every single Thriller Fest except the first one. I have met the most wonderful, supportive authors out there. Thriller Fest, I can't say enough good stuff about it.
Yeah, either can we. We always tell people to go to that.
Yeah, and in fact, I screwed up my courage and sent out requests for advance notes to some of my favorite authors. And Doug Lyle gave me a wonderful cover quote. D.P. Lyle,
right.
who is writes the Deb Walker thriller series and is a forensics expert, and by the way, loves cats. James
yeah.
Rollins, who is a veterinarian, and I love his Bloodline book, which also has a dog viewpoint character. And these are people that I idolized, but I met at Thriller Fest. So, yes, I did a lot of research. I asked people How do you handle this? I was sure I wanted to write a thriller. I studied, as you say, the difference between suspense, thrillers, you know, all of the different subgenres, and decided, you know, I want to do something a little different. I want to put the dog viewpoint character in there, but I don't want a talking dog. I don't want a fantasy character. I want a dog that reacts as a dog. He's not so much seeing things as smelling things, as hearing things, as reacting to those things, as having a stranger stare at him and his boy and feeling uncomfortable. And why would a dog feel uncomfortable? And doing all of that actually from his perspective. And some of the cool, really neat feedback that I've gotten on that is people saying, I learned more about my dog just reading this. I learned more about, you know, the relationship. I had, when I finished the book, I had to go and talk to my dog and pet my dog, and I've called him good dog more times today than I have in 6 months. That makes me feel good, too.
And you know, that's one of those things that, you know, when you kind of look back and you're talking about gratification, that you do feel gratified that you are, I guess, you know, it kind of solidifies yourself in your mind that you're like, see, I can make this leap. And
yes,
it might have taken me a little longer than I thought, but I can take it. And the one thing that I have is, what kind of dog is Shadow? And how do you pick that you're going to have this particular one from all the different kinds of breeds that are out there? How do you decide that Shadow is going to be exactly this kind of breed?
Oh, what a great question. Right now I'm on the Dog Read Discussion Group, which is about 6,000, it's a virtual book club, 6,000 people who love dogs and dog books, and that's been one of the questions, one of the discussions we've had. Shadow is a German Shepherd. He's 9 months old. He's not yet fully trained. He's not a fully trained service dog yet, and so he still has those puppyish antics going on and emotions as well. I love German Shepherds. I have a German Shepherd. If you go to shojai.com, you can see a trailer I put together that has my own German Shepherd in it, actually shot during that freak snowstorm a couple of years ago, some of the footage was. I chose a German Shepherd. People are familiar with service dogs for children. Often they're Golden Retrievers, they're Labradors. Really, pretty much any breed could do a lot of these functions. But for an autistic child, generally has very specific needs, and it has to be trained for a specific child. Often autistic children tend to wander. They tend to a dog breed like a German Shepherd that is a shepherd, described as a movable fence. They keep people or the cattle or whatever they're assigned to, they keep an eye on them and keep them safe. And so for an autistic child, a German Shepherd is a very good choice. Golden Retrievers may want to go play with other people. German Shepherds tend to identify
with... Dean Koontz
would
love you to hear you say that, because, of course, Dean Koontz is a huge Golden Retriever fan.
Dean,
I mean, that's his dog, yeah.
Well, absolutely, and I am a huge Dean Koontz fan also, and Golden Retrievers are for CCI, the Companion Canines for Independence, it's a different type of service dog, and they're ideal for that. So, but there are different types. If you want a service dog for an autistic child who is going into public, then you may want a German Shepherd, or you may choose to have a different type depending on the child's difficulties, what help that child needs. So I went with German Shepherd in part because that's my breed. I know them so well. Also because of the tracking dog issue. And my breeder here is local, and I've worked with her. She's a tracking dog expert, and so I know how that works. So a lot of this went into figuring out how I wanted to do this. And another confession. I know you love confessions here.
Yeah, see? Get them up. Come on.
Okay. The first draft of the book, I wrote the dog character's name was Magic, and that's my own dog's name. And then only once I had the book where I wanted to be, I changed the name of the dog. But that helped me get in touch with my personal experience, my personal connection with my dog. And I hope that comes through in Lost and Found. And I don't want listeners to think this is just a dog story. It really is not. It's a people story. It's a human relationship story. It's a love story. Two sisters who are in conflict that are trying to both want what's good for this little boy. It's a love story for the dog that wants love, and the little boy that he's assigned to can't give him love. So what does he want? But he can't. There's actually a character arc with the dog, which was a lot of fun to do. There are other parents with autistic children that are looking for a cure, and it's their love for their children. So there's a lot of emotion in this, as well as the roller coaster ride with the bad guys who truly think they're doing the work of the angels. And I think
that's an
interesting take.
Let's kind of, you know, real quick, let's kind of get into, you know, the villain of the story is how, I guess you want to kind of look at it when, because you know, the villain had to be one of the last things that you decided that you were going to do, because you already, you know, familiar with dogs. You're already familiar with kind of how and the plot was going to do. But how was the creation of the villain? Because, again, that's something that is much different than in nonfiction when you start putting, you know, things together. Now you have to start creating, you know, this fictional, total fictional character, because, you know, your main character and, you know, the dogs and the things like that, you know, loosely, you've already been kind of writing about that, so you're already familiar, but you're not familiar with the other side. So how is that dynamic that you kind of had to put yourself, you know, and sometimes you have to put yourself in an uncomfortable position in your mind when you start writing about villains and crimes and things that happen. How is that kind of dynamic to kind of get into? I know you started a little bit with horror, but horror is a little bit different, too, because there's really no rules in horror. You can do whatever you want.
No.
So how is that dynamic for you?
That was very interesting, because in the first drafts, because I am a first fiction writer, I know my bad guys were not the greatest. You know, they were kind of cliche types of things. So I had to work really hard to make them real, to make them likable in a way, to give them a motivation. It's not enough for a bad guy's motivation to be, oh, I am evil, bwahaha, I'm going to do bad stuff. They really need to have a good reason for doing everything they were doing. And I think that I managed to do that. The people that are the bad guys in this actually want to help autistic children and truly believe they have the solution. They've come up with this drug therapy that actually helps autistic children better communicate, get in touch with their feelings, have a connection with their family again, move toward that path of more normalcy and being able to connect with the world around them. It's a wonderful, wonderful thing. Every parent wants that. And the main bad guy in this, she had a son with autism and just happened to discover that this worked, and they have created a company and are distributing this, and as I said, truly believe they're doing the work of the angels. The problem is there's a bad side effect that if you don't follow the protocol exactly, then all hell breaks loose, and the children can you know, basically go crazy. Not a good thing.
Right.
So their whole concept is, well, listen, if people just followed our rules, there wouldn't be anything wrong, and you can't destroy this hope for millions just because a few people didn't follow directions. And, you know, if we have to take out three or four people to save millions of children, then it's worth it. And so these bad guys really think they're doing what's right. And I hope I say that in a good way and present that in a good way.
You can always have villains that have the best intentions in mind, just doing it how they're getting to those things are, you know, you always have, and I'm trying to remember the movie, I believe it was the Gene Hackman movie with Hugh Grant, where, you know, he wanted to help paraplegics. The problem was he was sacrificing, you know, homeless
yes.
people in order to prove his point. Well, you kind of can't do that. But he
right,
had good intentions
exactly.
in mind. So you kind of felt for him, and you felt for what he was trying to do, but you knew that what he was doing was wrong, and he couldn't continue to do that. But it wasn't a hateful thing. It was more along the lines of you almost kind of felt sorry that, you know, for them. And I guess that's kind of where it came down to.
Yeah, and that, that's similar to Lost and Found, only these folks kind of get in over their head, and once they've sacrificed one person and covered it up, then there's almost no going back, and then they have to do something else, and then do something else again. And you actually see the consequence of that miracle cure in the one, in Gerald, the one bad guy, because
right.
He was autistic, he's now high-functioning, but he still has he's no emotion, and it's some. His mother is the one that is heading all of this up, and again, it's that mother love. It's the love connection. A mom will do anything for her children. Her child can do no wrong, and look, this cure brought my son back to life. He's a genius. He's saving all these other children. How in the world could you question that?
Right. Well, I'll tell you what, Amy, we want to thank you so much for coming on today and talking about your latest book, Lost and Found, Amy Sojai.
Great.
I just blew it up. And it's Sojai.com, Sojai.com, and the book is Lost and Found. And you're giving it away right now. There's a giveaway on Goodreads until November 15th, so people can go to Goodreads and be able to put it for your book giveaway. And, Amy, we want to thank you so much for coming on, and we look forward to seeing what you have in the future, and we might catch up with you in Thrill Effect next year.
I would love that. Thank you so much, John.
Thank you. You have a good day.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. So again, everybody, there you go, Amy Sojai, and that is Sojai.com. The book is Lost and Found, to find out more. We are going to be back here in just a second with our next guest, Keith Rommel. And he is going to enlighten you about his book called The Cursed Man. And in the meantime, it is Halloween month, so let's hope you don't have a fear of the dark.
Down the wall and have you found your neck and fall? Where does the king fall through?
So welcome back, everybody. And I want to again thank our last guest, Amy Sojai, for being on the show with us in her book, Lost and Found. We are now entering our next segment, and we want to welcome our next guest to the show. And he has written his second book here called The Lurking Man in its Thanatology series. The first was called The Cursed Man. So it was a little bit off, and they're both out right now. But its author, Keith Rommel, is joining us to the show. So, Keith, we want to thank you so much for coming on. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well. Thank you for having me. And John, perfect song with the Iron Maiden, Fear of the Dark, to start it off. Excellent choice.
Wasn't it? Hey, you know,
yeah.
I try to like to do that. Not a lot of people even know who that was, but that's good that you picked that one out.
Yeah.
So here we go.
I'm a heavy metal fan.
Oh, yeah, I'm a huge heavy metal fan. And, in fact, we were just talking today, and I know Asia's not really heavy metal, but we're going to see them in concert. And then my 15-year-old daughter, she's into my kind of music, and her birthday's in December. And 2 years ago, I took her to see Kiss for the first time, and she loved it. That was her birthday present. Now, this year, I'm taking her to see Alice Cooper in concert. She really wanted to go, so that'll be her birthday present for this year.
That is a sweet birthday present. I've seen them both live, and they both put on a fantastic show.
Yeah, I've seen Alice Cooper a couple times, never seen Asia, but it's supposedly all four original members, and they're playing their first album in its entirety from beginning to end, so that should be fun to see, too.
Yeah, that'll be excellent.
But I could go talk music forever, but we're on here to talk about your books. And the two books that you have out now in your Thanatology series is The Cursed Man, and the most recent is book two called The Lurking Man. So can you kind of give everybody a little bit behind the scenes of how the series kind of going, maybe starting with The Cursed Man or bringing it up to The Lurking Man for people who are not familiar with your work and just hearing you for the first time?
Yes, absolutely. I actually have a little bit of a feel-good story, I guess you could say, with my first book, The Cursed Man. I had been seeking an agent for quite some time, and after I landed some agents, they were looking at the book for a while, and they had it for about 6.5 months. And after 6.5 months, it really didn't work out between myself and the agent. So I decided that I was going to try my hand at self-publishing, and while I was gearing up to do that, I actually had ended up meeting Lawrence, who's the owner of Sunbury Press out of Pennsylvania, and Lawrence had offered me a contract to publish through them. So the feel-good story is that, you know, here is a book that I was pretty much going to shelve, and then I ended up looking to self-publish it, and then a company picked it up. So it was real, real nice for me to be able to get that representation behind me to help me get the book out there a little bit further. And that story is about a man that's sitting inside of an insane asylum, and he believes that the entity of death is in love with him. It's pretty intense. I like to call that. Go ahead, John.
No, I think I was clearing my throat. Go ahead.
Okay. That story I like to call like a thinking man's book because it's extremely in-depth, and it requires, for people that really like to be challenged with their fiction, this is a book that will definitely challenge you on where the story is going and where it ends up. Very few people have I heard that actually can figure out what's going on in the end. And then what I did was I introduced The Lurking Man this year, which is a little bit of a simpler story, and this story is about a woman that wakes up underneath a spotlight, and she has this complete blackness around her, and she hears something moving around in the blackness, and, you know, by the unfolding of the first chapter, we find out that the entity of death is occupying the darkness, and he's come to make her an offer. And I can't really tell you what the offer is because that's kind of the spin of the book. That's part of the spin, but it's basically the a woman's judgment day and coming face-to-face with all the wrongs that she's done in her life. And the Thanatology series in its whole can be read in any order. The books do connect, but they connect in a very, very subtle way, and each book is a standalone story.
Interesting. So you kind of, now, again, your website is Keith Rommel, and that's R-O-M-M-E-L, and it's .weebly, W-E-E-B-L-Y.com for people to find out more information. And, of course, your books are available at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and places can find them. Now, when you were deciding that this was something that you were going to do, did you make a conscious effort while you were doing the series to write it that way? So the books are kind of loosely put together, but can be done maybe out of order. That way people don't have to kind of go back and read the first one to the second.
Yeah, I think it was somewhat unplanned. The whole idea of entitling this the Thanatology series, and for those who don't know what Thanatology is, I thought it was like a cult sort of thing. So, yeah, I got a chuckle out of it when I first stumbled upon it, too. But it's actually a the scientific studying of death and dying.
Okay.
And what I do is I take that and I put a fiction spin on that, maybe what somebody is doing as far as a deathbed dream or what have you. And it's not gory horror. It's more in the line of suspense. It does have some underlying horror that runs through the story, both of the stories. And
right.
You know, that pretty much sums up what the Thanatology is. And as far as connecting the stories, I didn't really decide that until I was writing the second one, because when I wrote the second one, it was actually really dramatically connected to the first one. But as you start writing, things start taking upon a life of their own.
And correct.
And the story actually ended out being something completely different than what I had mapped out. So it's real interesting to see sometimes how these things, you know, how you originally plan them and then how the characters start taking a life of their own.
Now, you had written a couple books before this, so then when you decided to kind of fall into this, and you could tell that there's like a little supernatural entity also into these books. Were these kind of the books that you were hoping that you could write kind of from the beginning? Were they in the works for quite some time? You just didn't quite know how to maybe put them down? Or was it something kind of on the spur of the moment that just kind of hit you one night laying in bed or sitting on the bathroom and you're like, okay, that's it. That's what it is. Oh, I think we lost Keith. Hold on. I'm going to try to get him back here. Keith?
Yes.
Oh, okay. I don't know what happened.
Well, cell phone technology kind of dropped me off.
There you go. That's okay. Now, you probably didn't hear any freaking word I just said, but here we go. So, I'm going to try to remember what I said. Now, like I said, you had written a couple books before, and now you decided to write this anthology. Now, was this something that you originally thought that you were going to write always because, you know, there's a little supernatural element and things like that in there? Or was it kind of the spur of the moment? Were you just kind of sitting down sometime and it just kind of hit you in the head? Or was it something that you were thinking about for quite some time, that this is what you really wanted to write and this is kind of where you're going to be staying now for quite some time in your writing?
Okay. That's actually a multi-part answer. The Thanatology series was not planned. It actually took place, not to get all sad and dark on people, but my father had passed away 3 years ago from cancer. And I had all but given up on my writing because of, you know, when you mourn somebody that's very close to you, it touches very close to home. And it kind of changed my outlook on a few things. And he was a very big supporter of my writing. And, you know, after a little period of time had gone by, I started investigating what scientists and what people know about death and the dying process. And that's how I came across the Thanatology series. So that's what spawned the Thanatology series. And I will be staying in this for a while. I'm already part of the way through book three, which to me is a pretty interesting premise, because I always introduce death in a different way. And this time death is going to be represented as a young child and an old woman. So death is going to take on two parts. They are two separate entities. And they will represent the representation of the old woman, and the young boy is obviously the beginning of life and the end of life. And this one's turning out to be, you know, quite nice. And I also will be stepping out of the Thanatology series later on this year. I had already written a book. It's already in queue. And one of them is called You Killed My Brother. It's a little bit of a weird title, but it's like a made-for-television type show, fast-paced thriller. A lot of fun. It was probably the most fun that I had writing any book, because I didn't really put the pressure or the burden of writing on me when I was going through writing this stuff.
Right.
And then the last one I'm going to be releasing outside of the Thanatology series, again, it's already written, is called Among the People, and that's about a story about an angel that had fallen from the grace of God with Satan, and now he's falling from the grace of Satan here on earth, and he's trying to hide, hence the title Among the People, to try to avoid the minions of hell that are coming after him. So he kind of gets the minions of hell running around among the people, and it gets to be quite an interesting story, and that will be released as a novel and a graphic novel at the same time.
Wow, so you have a lot of things that you have planned, and I think that your fans now, and again, we're speaking with author Keith Rommel, and it's keithrommel.weebly.com. The books are The Cursed Man and The Lurking Man for people to kind of find to go out and check this out. Now, so you have definitely a path that you know that you're going to be headed on for quite some time. And, you know, that's very enlightening to know that you know, you already kind of, I mean, hell, you already took my question at the very end, you know, what's got the future? Well, hell, we already figured that one out. and that's a good thing because, you know, you're very focused and you kind of know, which makes me think that, you know, the series is only going to get better because you have put a lot of thought into this and how it's going to work itself out. Instead of just writing, I guess you want to say, when people write series, they tend to be boring and stale because it's basically the same book written over and over and over and over and over again, and I think a lot of people get tired of that. And so it's very refreshing to see that you're kind of changing things up a little bit and adding an extra element, graphic novel and things like that into it.
Yeah, as far as the graphic novel goes, I've been working with guys from Germany for the past 5 years, and we're doing a lot of things through Google Translate, which is really interesting. I've never actually physically spoken to them on the telephone or on the internet. It's always been done through the email. So any direction that I give them on art panels, any sort of scenes, these guys are actually doing it, and we're doing some things through Google Translate, which is really cool. And when these guys try to contact me via email and they you know, put the written down instead of doing it through Google Translate, when they write to me in English, it's really cool because you see the language barrier and stuff and how what we call things, they don't quite understand it, and I don't quite understand where they're coming from. But it's really neat, and it's unique, and people can see the cover to the graphic novel of Among the People online. That's actually online. It's the full cover of the angel falling out of the clouds. So that's a little taste of what's come in 2013 on that. And I did make a conscious effort in the Thanatology series to make sure that the reader didn't feel like they had to buy into every book to understand what was going on.
Okay.
Because I felt it was important that, you know, if one book shined over another one, that it was a self-contained story. And I actually had somebody that asked me a very interesting question, and they said to me, what book do you think is better? And I said, I think that The Cursed Man is better, but I think people will like The Lurking Man better. And the reason behind that is because of going back to what I originally said, that the Cursed Man is a very complex storyline, and it requires a lot of thinking, a lot of focus, which is great because it challenges your imagination. And The Lurking Man, it has the twists in it, but it's a little bit more mass-appealing friendly, if you would. So I think that that's the way that the third book is going that's the way it's turning out right now, is it's going to be a little bit more mass-appealing friendly. It's not going to challenge the reader so hard. It will challenge the reader and introduce different takes on death, different takes on the characters that are a victim of death, why they're there, why they're being judged, and how they can get out of the situation that they're in if they can.
So if you had to say, okay, fans of this author are going to like my books, who would you put in kind of that blank to kind of give people an idea of exactly what they're going to get when they pick up The Cursed Man and The Lurking Man?
I don't want to really throw people
because
off.
Because some of it sounds like, and I'm just going to say, some of it sounds like Piers Anthony, you know, when he kind of did On a Pale Horse, you know, how he changes death and it's the normal people. And I love the supernatural aspect of it and how you're bringing in, you're kind of tying in a couple, you have your main kind of suspense genre, but then you're kind of bringing in some other ones into the story. So, it's very unique, and that's why I kind of think a lot of people are going to be like, okay, so what exactly kind of is it? So if we could kind of maybe put an author to it, it might give them a little better understanding, because it is a very complex thing that you have put together, which is not easy to do.
No, that's not easy to do. And just so people know, The Cursed Man took me over 5 years to write. That's how intricate the web that is woven into that story. And I made sure that every single thing that's going on, and believe me, there's a lot going on in that story, that when you come to the end, everything is wrapped up in the last four pages. So I made sure of that. So, you know, in that sense, that's the challenging part, is that you don't really get until the end of the book. You don't really get all the answers until you get there. But I think Piers Anthony is a great example, and there's a lot of readers. A reviewer from the UK, he compared the writing style of The Cursed Man to Stephen King, and God bless, I wish I had one-tenth of his success. But I think it would appeal to Stephen King's fans, because it's that type of story. It's the early Stephen King stuff. I was a very, very big fan of the Anne Rice, the early Memnock the Devil, obviously the Vampire Lestat, Queen of the Damned. So I kind of like that. Mine doesn't deal with vampires. Mine deals with somebody that's potentially dead and dealing with the entity of death. And maybe the entity of death would be more like Lestat than anything else. But I think, you know, any of your mainstream horror, suspense, I really think that the book has more suspense than it does horror, although there are elements of horror in there. And it's not blood
but
and gore.
But it's not the right. That's the thing that people understand. When they hear horror, they're like, oh, no, 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 no. Horror and gore are two totally separate things. And true horror, like you're mentioning in your book, is exactly what I fall in love with, but I don't fall in love with the gore. I don't need to see and hear all the gore. To me, that's actually comedy, because it's not scary. It's just comedic. There's nothing scary about seeing that. And I think that, and so I think what you've done is exactly the correct way when you're doing the horror that way, because, hey, that's what, you know, it's almost what, when you're talking horror, it's almost what you don't see that you think is coming that scares you more than what actually comes. I think that's why the movie Halloween was so great.
Yes, that's actually very well put, because that's, you know, my whole thing is to put the reader with the main character and have you brought through the emotional ringer. And there's a little bit of a physical ringer that these guys go through. And these ups and downs, and, for example, right now, a lot of people, the feedback on The Lurking Man, which is the second book, the feedback on that book right now is that they really hate the main character, but by the end of the book, they really want this character to come out of all of this holy heck that she's in. So I really try to get you to connect with the main character and feel everything and experience everything that they're experiencing. And what they're experiencing is more of an emotional terror or an emotional horror than like what we were just talking about with the blood and guts and gore, because that's not really something that I focus on.
Here's the other thing. Let's kind of switch gears a little, because we have a lot of authors, a lot of inspiring authors and people that really want to write, and they listen to the show. And it's always great to see somebody who's kind of generally new out of the gate. You kind of generally new out of the gate here. And now you're starting to get into the realm of, okay, I got my writing out there. Now who the hell's going to read it? And how am I going to get them to read it? And so you found me, and we start, you know, you come on this show and you go on other shows. How has it been if people, when they go on your site, Keith Rimmel, that's one L, .weebly, weebly.com, and they see, they're going to see the one thing where you have kind of like your tour schedule. And let me tell you, you got things going on all the way from October 1st to the 15th. Every day you got something going on.
Yes.
How did you kind of put that together And how has the experience been right now? Because you're 6 days into this tour, and like tomorrow you go to, you know, you have another blog that you're going with. You just had one with a blog lady last night. How has the experience been? What can you kind of tell people that are kind of new and fresh into this, how your path has gone?
My path actually started after all the attention that the first book had gotten, and I had gotten to know some of the bloggers, because when they like your work, they kind of gravitate towards you, and they, you know, they compliment you, and I think that a lot of people really want to help authors that are really just your average everyday guy, and you're trying to break into a scene that's very difficult, and you have a lot of competition. And right on the top of my webpage, I give credit to the woman that inspired me to do this, and she's helping me through it. Her name is Erin, and she runs Over the Hook of the Book blog, and she's the one that helped me put this thing together. And she's really the one that's been giving me direction and really keeping me on path as far as what the guest posts are going to be, what I should write about, giving me suggestions with that. So it's really, really good to, you know, create these relationships and these bonds with these bloggers, because these bloggers really have a lot of influence, and they can, you know, they help each other out, and it's a domino effect. You get one, you may get a dozen. You may get a dozen, it may be 100.
Right.
So, and I didn't have very much time to prepare for this blog, because we kind of started to do this on the fly. So it was like towards the middle of September is when we really started nailing things down, and then I'm hurrying up and I'm writing some articles and I'm trying to figure out some unique ways to write these things to draw interest. And there's some that are coming out that are really good. There's one right now that's on Kitty Ballard's website, which I suggest that everybody goes and reads, and it's actually the true story on how I come up with my stories that are fiction, that are really true stories, but all I do is I fictionize them. So
now, does a tour like this, I mean, does it cost a lot? I mean, do you have to put a lot of money out there, or is it just mainly a lot of work and effort to get these people contacted and to get on? Because a lot of people don't realize, when you come on this show, and I get emailed all the time by guests, and they're always like, okay, so what are the questions going to be so I can prepare? I don't tell you nothing. I say, I don't give you questions, because I don't want it to be scripted. I want you to be from the heart. I want you to be authentic, and therefore no one gets a question from me in advance. And I think that a lot of the times, a lot of blogs, maybe they do kind of give you that kind of thing, but, you know, what do you think about, you know, I don't know how that's kind of been for you.
Yeah, they don't. The only thing that I get in advance is the Q&A, any author interviews, obviously, because we're doing it through the written word rather than through communication of a, you know, verbal communication like we're doing right now. So the only thing that I previously had any preparedness for would be the author question and answer, where a blogger would just like to interview the author. All of the other things, and as far as, let me back up a little bit. No, there's no cost out of my pocket for this.
Okay.
And that just goes into networking and being consistent and persistent and trying to put out a good quality work and just trying to try to knock down the right doors, such as what you did for me, is I kept knocking on your door and you opened up the door for me. So
right.
My suggestion is to write articles that suit your genre. The articles that you put out, for example, I'm putting out an article on a romance site, a suspense horror author putting out an article on a romance site. So all I did was I took, this is going to be an interesting article. This one's upcoming. I think this is in about 3 days. This one is, you know, spun so that it can kind of take your romance people and kind of show them a little different side of the suspense genre and the horror genre, that it's not really all dark. So I think it's just a matter of creating these articles and getting in touch with these bloggers and trying to get yourself in there. Offer them something. Offer them a giveaway. Offer them an article. An article could be a writer's help how to write a query letter, whatever your experience that you could help other writers at is absolutely huge. I mean, I scoured the internet for years trying to figure out and find my voice in these books.
Yeah.
And it took a lot of work and a lot of time and a lot of patience. And, you know, some of these doors are now opening for me, which I'm very, very appreciative of, because it's hard. And I know that, each author is, although I wish each author very well in what they're doing, you know, I'm vying for a spot, too.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to find my voice. I'm trying to get people to hear me. And my only thing is just be persistent and you know, make sure that your message is positive and helpful to others.
Well, Keith, we enjoyed you so much coming on. We want to thank you so much. And that is your books here, The Cursed Man and The Lurking Man, available now, two books that you have in your Thanatology series. And that's keithromell.weebly.com for your site. So, Keith, thank you so much for coming on. When you get further along, contact us, bring you back on, and we'll see kind of how you've been progressing.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Thank you very, very much, John. I really appreciate the invitation.
All right, Keith. Enjoy your day, and we'll talk with you soon.
Okay. Take care now.
Okay. You too. So, again, everybody, Keith Romell, latest book, The Lurking Man, second in his Thanatology series. The first was The Cursed Man. You can catch them all at keithromell.weebly.com. And go to Amazon and go to Barnes & Noble and check those books out. We now are going to take just a short break, a couple minutes, and we're going to be back. I need to get something to drink, and I might have to go to the bathroom. And I also have talked to my next guest. His name is David Lyons, and then he's going to be on the show here in just a second. So in the meantime, we played this last week. I liked it so much I want to play it again, and you should be able to recognize it. But just there's just no singing, so maybe get to see who it actually is playing it. Talk to you soon. Back, everybody, and we want to thank our guests that have been on the show here. This is our last segment, Amy Sojai and her book, Lost and Found, and we just had Keith Rommel on and talked about his books, The Cursed Man and The Lurking Man. So this is our last segment, and what better way to end it than with author David Lyons. If you've listened to the shows in the past, you listened to an excerpt that we played of the book that we're going to talk about now called Ice Fire, and it's davidlyonsauthor.com is his website. And David, we want to thank you so much for coming on. How you doing?
I'm doing great, John. Thanks for having me on the show.
And
hey, by and
the
way,
yeah.
I thought you were going to stump me, but even I guessed that the song was a Michael Jackson song.
That's true, but who was the person playing the instrumental? That's the stumper.
Oh, well, you got
that,
me there.
See? The stumper is actually, his name is John Five, and he's a guitar player, and people might know him. They don't might know his name, but they'll know that he was a guitar player for Marilyn Manson. And he is coming out, and he, on his own, a fabulous guitar player, playing nothing like you would think that it was Marilyn Manson stuff. A lot of those guys, of course, don't. And that's who that was. So, yes, very interesting.
Fascinating. Every day is a learning experience.
Exactly. I can teach so many people a lot of crap on here. A lot of crap that means nothing. That might only work on Jeopardy. That's it. But here you go. And I'll tell you, the first thing right out of the box is I love the character name, Jock Boucher. And the reason why is because whenever I see the name Jock, the first thing, of course, I think of, and I don't know if anybody else does, is Dallas. And that's
right.
The only really name that I've known is that is, of course, you know, Jock Ewing was the father of you know, J.R. and Patrick and or Bobby and Dallas. And I love when you put the thing on there, the renegade Cajun federal judge. So you got to tell us now, in the author's words, because we heard the excerpt on the radio before now, give us a little bit behind Ice Fire about the character Jock and kind of how, you know, the behind-the-scenes things are going.
Well, let me first address the how the name came to me, because that's a good starting off point. His name, actually, the given name was Jacques, because he's Cajun, and he grew up speaking uh-huh. French. He grew up in the Louisiana Bayou. Very humble beginnings. And he kind of bootstrapped himself up through life, and among many other of his talents, he was an athlete as a young man. And when he went to school, people could not always pronounce the French, and so with his athletic ability, Jacques became Jacques. That's how the name became into being.
Okay.
And Boucher is one of many well-known Cajun names in the area. And
right.
It's Boucher, not... And as I mentioned in the book as well, it's...
Yeah, and I thought Boucher, I screwed that one up. Yeah, Boucher. I should have known from New Orleans and French, I should have picked that out, that it was French, though. You there?
So more about the book.
Yeah.
Well, as you said, Jacques Boucher is a newly appointed federal judge in New Orleans. And the book starts out kind of as a whodunit. In the very first couple of pages, we have a murder. And it is of a lawyer who is about to meet with the FBI and present evidence of his allegations of judicial corruption. But the night before he has this meeting, he is killed and left dead on the side of the road. Then we flash forward 20 years into a courtroom scene. Jacques Boucher has been asked to stand in for a senior judge who's had a heart attack that very morning. And he, as I say, is new to the bench. And one of the last cases he hears this morning is of a fugitive who's been in hiding for 20 years, who's brought in on an old bench warrant, and Boucher dismisses the case against him when he finds out what it was all about. And this scientist claims to have invented a method for extracting a new form of energy from the ocean floor called methane hydrate. And he claims that judicial corruption was involved in the theft of this process decades ago, and that's what drove him into hiding, and that's what led to the death of his lawyer way back when.
Uh-huh.
And we quickly find that, Jacques Boucher is not your typical judge because he can't seem to keep himself on the bench. He becomes very involved in this. In fact, even goes to the bottom of the ocean to find a little more about methane hydrate. By the way, you mentioned Dallas. After the book was printed, I was looking up consultants who knew something about methane hydrate and spoke to a gentleman in New Orleans who told me before the series was broadcast that methane hydrate would be playing quite a role in the first several episodes of Dallas. I don't know.
Yeah,
if you've
and it
that
did.
Yet.
It did actually. Yeah, I watched the new series, and that's funny because it actually does.
Yes, it does. Yes. So I thought that timing was quite coincidental.
Huh. Now, a lot of people, you know, when they go on, they're like, oh, you know, you're writing about legal and this and that. Well, the good thing is that, you know, you are a lawyer. And I always tell people, you need to write about what you know. So therefore, you have the believable aspect because you're going to bring in aspects that you know from your profession. And when people read when they read it, they know that it's authentic. Now, were you always kind of thinking out of the box that you wanted to kind of get into this realm and was the judge the way you wanted to go instead of an attorney? Because typically that's the way that they go. You're kind of the first to maybe do like the renegade judge that I can remember. A lot of them, of course, always end up being attorneys. So what made you decide to go that way instead of going the attorney route?
John, it has to do a lot with the way that I write. And I don't mean to dance around the question, but I'm what colleagues of mine have called an organic writer. It's kind of seat-of-the-pants kind of writing.
Mm-hmm.
And when I write, I generally have a very clear idea of how the book starts. I have a general idea of how the book ends. And I try and work as hard as I can to get from point A to point B. And that's 300 or 400 pages that I have to fill in the meantime. When I got to the judge, this is after the initial couple of pages, so very early in the book, I'm introducing the character, and I thought, just as he appeared on the page, this is my protagonist. I didn't really intend to write a book about a federal judge. Now, I was thinking, okay, what else is there left? We have detectives, we have CIA and FBI agents, and on and on. Is there something that has not yet been covered? So from that aspect, yeah, I thought this would be something new. Let's try this. At the same time, just by the very nature of the position, being a judge is going to limit one when you're writing thriller fiction, because what does a judge do? He sits at the bench and he deliberates and he adjudicates. And none of those are associated with a great deal of action. So I had to make him a renegade.
Now, here's the one thing. When you were kind of writing the book and kind of putting it kind of all together, and again, we're speaking with author David Lyons here, and the book is called Ice Fire. And you can find him at davidlyonsauthor.com. That's L-Y-O-N-S, author.com. Do you have, like, when you kind of go back and you finish it, can you kind of pick out, like, one scene, one sentence maybe, that kind of encompasses the whole book as a whole, that you just feel like, damn, I nailed that part, and that's kind of like the essence of the book? Did you feel that in there somewhere?
One sentence?
Could be, or maybe like a scene or something, without maybe giving anything away, but just one part that you write and that you read back through and you're like, that right there is the essence of what I was trying to get out, and I captured it.
Well, I can't think of a sentence, but I can think of a turning point. And that's
there you
go. That's the very beginning of the book, when Judge Boucher, acting as a judge, meets this man who he has just set free earlier that day. Outside of his home late that evening, and has a conversation with him. There's a point at which he takes a personal interest in the man beyond that of a judge and a party to litigated matter before him. And at that point, I know that this guy is he's not going to be your average judge, and he's not going to limit his activities to a courtroom. So it was at that turning point I knew that I had a character who was going to be very, very proactive. And it happened very early in the book.
Okay. And that was kind of one of those things. Was it kind of like a surprise when you kind of had it out? Was it something that you knew this is what you wanted to do, but you didn't know quite maybe the impact of how it was going to affect the book when you ended up finishing it?
No. The answer to your question very simply is no.
No.
When I first started writing, one of the first people to read my book said, you know, reading your books, it's like watching a movie. That's something I remember from years ago. And I answered them saying, you know, writing my book is kind of like me watching that same movie. So I'm not saying that I do it without forethought, certainly not. But so much of it comes as I write.
Okay.
And that's not easy, and that's not always straight and true. I mean, you're going to have to go back and rewrite again and again and again to make sure that your character remains consistent. But basically, as I said earlier, I start with a clear idea of the beginning, a more vague idea of the ending, and just kind of figure out my way through. I sit down virtually every day, and I write till I reach my word count. And some days, it is just like magic. And some days, of course, it's horrifying because nothing comes. And a writing session can be 2 hours. A writing session can be 8 hours or more just to meet that same word count. And that's basically the nature of my process. So if you're asking me, did I, like, insert a certain sentence that I thought would define what's to come? No, I did not. What does surprise me so very often is that I will have a character say or do something on page 32 and understand perfectly what, in fact, he was trying to accomplish on page 168. But there's something in the subconscious. I just don't know what it is, but it fortunately, most of the time, hopefully, comes together.
Now, when we kind of look at the character and now you're writing, is this going to be an ongoing series? Are you going to have standalone books more along the lines? What are you going to kind of do in the future with your writing and with Jacques? Are we going to see him continue forward, or what do you got going on?
I'm working on the edit of the next Jacques Boucher thriller right now. Working with my editor. We're right in the middle of it, and it should be out next summer. I'm also working on the edit of the paperback, which will be out in March. That's a different kind of process, as you realize. The book's already in hardcover. I'm going through what they call the first-pass copies, looking more for typographical errors than anything else. But, of course, it necessitates reading the book again.
Right.
So I'm preparing I Spire for its paperback release in March, and I'm working towards the next book, which will be released about less than a year from now. And it is a series in that this is a continuing character.
Now, what's kind of been your most favorite part of going through this process? Because, you know, Ice Fire is your first book. You know, it's your first book to the new series and everything. So what's been the most enjoyable part when the book was finally done and you wrote the end that you've enjoyed as you've gone through this process now?
My favorite part of the entire publishing process is the editing. I have enjoyed that more than I can possibly express.
And a lot of people think that that's pulling teeth. That's funny.
No, not for me. I'm working with Emily Bessler, who's one of the finest editors in the business.
Mm-hmm.
And I really enjoy seeing the perspective of my work through someone else. Sometimes they see what I see and what I want them to see, and sometimes they don't. And when you're working with someone as professional as Emily is, generally when there is a correction suggested, it's all for the good, and I really, really welcome it. But just the process itself, it's just simply fascinating. And it's not just – there are several aspects to the editing also. There is what we call content edit, and then there is the line edit. The second part of the process is extremely detailed. Boy, do I give those people a lot of credit, because they go through everything and they check your proper names to make sure that everything's properly capitalized and so on and so on.
Right.
And they will check details that escape me that I never would have thought that anyone would catch. I mean, the chronology of your dates, for one thing. But so many other tiny, tiny little details that you just simply don't think about, much less look for. And these people do, and as I say, I give them all the credit that is due. But the edit process in itself, to me, has been very, very enjoyable.
Now was it nerve-wracking, though, when you first saw the book live on the shelf, and now you were kind of in the firing lines from reviewers and from people out there that you've never met that could either rip your work to shreds, praise your work? How was the anxiety of that when you first had to realize that you were getting yourself involved in that?
Well, I've kind of steeled myself to that over the years. I want to answer that question, but I want to kind of answer another question that I've heard you ask before. So don't let me forget to get back on track here. You have asked other authors that you've spoken to what advice they would give to other writers.
Oh yeah.
And I'm addressing now those who are just starting out, those who feel that they're at the stage where they want to turn their writing from a pastime into something more. These are the ones that I'm speaking to. And my advice to them is find a writer's group in your local community and join it. And you'll find it to be so rewarding in so many, many respects. And now getting back to your question, I've had criticism over the years. I mean, I was in a writer's group, and for 10 years I never missed a meeting. And I read every opportunity that I had. And you're in a familiar group, and that's certainly more helpful, and generally they can be more friendly, but you're going to hear the other kind of criticism as well. And it helps you. It helps you know that other aspect of this profession is going to be out there. And if you're going to be a writer, you had better prepare yourself for that as well. The tough thing is when you really don't agree with someone who has criticized you and you don't have any way to respond or to explain, but that's just a frustration that you have to live with. But I've been fortunate. I'm just over the moon with the reviews that I've had of the book, those from other professionals as well as those from readers. And on that point, I've had a lot. I mean, we're in the social media era, so Facebook, Twitter, Goodreads, I do all of that. But thank you for mentioning my website on the air, because I really do enjoy hearing from my readers, and a good many of them do email me. And their comments are just wonderful. I'm so pleased with how many. In fact, my readers started calling them Jacques Boucher thrillers before my publisher did. They immediately gravitated toward the character. And their comments are constructive, helpful, and very, very positive. I had one woman email me telling me, I can't recall the exact words, but she said, that murder on page 35 is the most original murder I have ever read. And I thought that was fascinating. And then she went into a very, very lengthy description of why. And she, it turns out, is both a registered nurse and a critical care nurse.
Ah.
And she knew exactly what she was talking about and why she thought that this particular idea that I had used was so good and so original. So any of those of you out there who have read I Spy, love to hear from you. Love to hear from you, and we'll certainly be back in touch with you.
Yeah, because now that you are into the series part and you're going to start writing the series, I was always, you know, it goes both ways. Some people will say that it's easier to write a series. Some people say it's more difficult to write a series. I have no kind of way either way on that thing. The most difficult part that I see now is, let's say you're getting yourself into book 3 and 4, and the readers are going to remember this, and maybe you won't, and that's what the copy, that's what the editing part is coming. You have to remember what you did back in book 1 to make sure that you don't screw up going down through book 3s and 4 and so on. Are you keeping a lot of notes for those kinds of things, like people's favorite colors or things that they do or little twitches or things that you make sure that you don't forget that you put in that readers are going to call you out on?
John, I'm making a note right here as we're talking. To start doing that.
To make a note about that.
Okay. I will start doing that. One of the challenges that I see is that when you have a repeat character, obviously their background is important. And in
right.
your first novel, of course, you're going to relate that background to your reader. But how do you keep repeating that background in subsequent books? You obviously have to take shortcuts and eliminate the major part of the description of your character's beginnings, but it's going to be challenging.
And the other thing is now, in, you know, when you talk about social media and everything else that's going on, of course, the other thing that's out there big is self-publishing. And did you ever come to a point when you had this finished and you had it ready to go that if it wasn't going to get picked up by, like, you know, by Simon & Schuster, who you're with, that you were going to go ahead and just put it out on your own because you felt that strong and you wanted to get it out and you just wanted to get the series going because you loved writing it so much? Was that ever a thought process if it didn't happen with you, with Simon & Schuster?
Well, with this book, I didn't have time to think that. It was accepted pretty quickly. But I'm no stranger to self-publishing. I have been writing for many years, and I self-published a number of novels. I've taken them out of circulation right now because they were different genres that I experimented through my writing path: historical fiction, general fiction, that kind of thing, that really have nothing to do with what I'm trying to do today. I didn't want to confuse readers. I'd like rather have them focus on my current efforts. But I am very, very supportive of self-publishing. In fact, the so-called guru of self-publishing, Dan Pointer, whose name you might be familiar with, is a friend of mine. And he gave me great, great encouragement in my early days. So that is definitely a vehicle for writer. I mean, we're so fortunate these days. We have hardcover books, we have paperback books, we have e-books, we have trade paperbacks, we have audio books, and a great, great many formats in which we can get our work out to people. So I think it's a wonderful time for writers.
So kind of like the last question here, and again, we're speaking with David Lyons, author of Icefire. DavidLyonsAuthor.com is his website. Give us one character in the book Icefire that surprised you, that you're going to maybe continue going forward, or people might see coming in later books that you didn't think when you started writing was going to have this big of a voice or this big of an impact within the story?
Fitch, Detective Fitch, but it's Fitch, just Fitch. He doesn't like to be called by his title, and he hates his first name. And he meets Jacques Boucher very, very early in the first story. And he's a grizzled old detective, older brother, and he becomes like an older brother to Jock. There could not be two men more different, but they do become quite close. I do want to say one thing, if I could, John, if we're closing up. I have been extremely, extremely fortunate to have my very first novel, Icefire, accepted or chosen by Reader's Digest Select Editions. And it will be out in the abridged version later this month. And Reader's Digest, of course, is a brand name that I grew up with. And when you look at all the literary figures who have been chosen by them over the years, it's quite an honor, and I'm very, very proud of it.
Yeah, and did you just hear about that? Did that just kind of come across the wire this week, or?
No, I've known about it since about the time that the book came out, the hardcover book in early May. And it was then scheduled for their fall edition, which will be out, I believe, later this month. But in the next compendium of Reader's Digest Select Editions, look for Icefire. And it also has been sold in a number of foreign languages.
Well, David, exciting news going on. You have nothing but an exciting career ahead of you. We want to thank you so much for coming on today and talk about your book, Icefire, that when the next one comes out, I don't know if you have it named yet, keep us in touch. We'd love to have you on to kind of see how Boucher and Fitch are kind of getting along with each other.
Jacques Boucher and Fitch. Yes, indeed I will. And I thank you so much for the opportunity. This is just a great, great forum for writers and readers.
Well, thank you. And your $5 is in the mail for that.
Okay. Thank you, John.
All right, David. You enjoy yourself. And again, come back on when we have book two, and then let's see, and let's continue the series.
I look forward to that. Thank you, John.
All right, you have a good one. Thanks so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye. So again, everybody, author David Lyons, the book is Ice Fire. We want to thank all the guests that we've had on the show today. It's been a fabulous show. We are going to be back on, let me check the schedule here. When are we going to be back on? We're going to be back on October 20th, and that's a very special show. Now that I remember, we're off next week, we're going to be back October 20th. On October 20th, we're going to have John Conley, Sandra Parshall, Tasha Alexander, and Sam Hawken. The reason why it's extremely important on this show is because we're doing something that's different. Authors John Conley, of course you should know, and Tasha Alexander, they are going to be giving away one signed copy of their book to someone who listens to the show. I'm not quite sure how I'm going to do it, but I think I'm going to kind of have maybe some kind of a keyword or some kind of a question that you're just going to have to answer. You send in with your name and address. And if you win, you'll get a signed copy of the book sent to you from John and from Tasha. Just one. So you only win one or the other. You can't win both. So you're going to win one or the other. And that's something that we're doing new, and hopefully it catches on. We did find out that coming up also, for the first time ever, we're going to finally get Ted Decker on the radio show, and that's going to happen on November the 17th. Looking forward to that. We have a little bit of sparse schedule coming up late in the year as the holidays and things come up. A lot of people kind of go out. We kind of, you know, take a little bit of a break. And so there'll be a little bit more sparse shows. Right now, if you go to the website, suspensemagazine.com, and click on Suspense Radio, you only see three dates up, but we are filling another one here for the first week of November. We're going to have, I think November 3rd, we're going to have a show on for that one. And so you're going to be seeing the guests kind of filter a little bit more, but it is going to be a little bit more sparse. So don't worry, but we're still going to have great stuff coming out for you. If you haven't got your five free issues, What's Your Own Stupid Fault, and you can still get them, all you got to do is email us at editor@suspensemagazine.com, and we'll send it out to you. Again, we don't do anything with your email addresses. I just keep them so I can email you, but they don't go anywhere else, so you don't have to worry about anybody going to email you some spam or anything else, because we don't do that with people, because I don't like it, so I'm not going to do it to anybody else. But again, we want to thank all of our guests that have been on the show here today. Amy Sojai, S-O-S-H-O-J-A-I, .com is her website, with her book that was in there, Lost and Found. And then we also have on there Keith Rommel with The Cursed Man and The Lurking Man. And then we have on David Lyons, who just had Ice Fire, and that's DavidLyonsAuthor.com. And for Keith Rommel, it's KeithRommel.Weebly.com to find out more information there. So, again, we'll see you in 2 weeks. Enjoy yourself. Watch some football. Do whatever you got to do. October, the greatest month of the year. The magazine is out now. Email us if you want a copy of it for free issues. Check it out. John Sanford, Sandra Brown, Peter May, Peter James, Spencer Quinn, all highlighted in the magazine. So, until then, we'll see you later. Have a good one. Bye.